3 minutes after 8:00, and the House Judiciary Committee is in session.
Got dead air time.
I don't think I let Jane know that we were getting started. It just occurred to me that... Could you let Jane know I got started, please? And we're going to take up two pieces of legislation this morning. Representative Dahlstrom will not be with us. In attendance are Representative Lynn, Representative Ramirez, Representative Gatto, and Representative Holmes. I thank everybody for being punctual this morning. Our first piece of business is going to be to read into the record the intent of a conceptual amendment that was adopted. Did Representative Gruenberg offer this amendment?
Yes, he did.
Okay, then I'm going to hold off on that until Representative Gruenberg is in the room. We're just going to read the language into the record to make sure it was the intent of the amendment sponsor. We're going to take up two pieces of legislation today. First, we're going to take up Machine Gun Kelly's bill, 186, and then Representative Johansson's bill, House Bill 36. We are joined today by Representative Kelly and Representative Johansson. We're happy to have both of them here in the room. So with that, we're ready for a little color this morning. So bring it on. Good morning, gentlemen. It's nice to see you.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman.
Good morning.
Members of the committee. My name is Mike Kelly. I'm represented from District 7.
Mike, if you give me just 1 second, sure. Would somebody introduce this bill, please? The CS needs to be introduced. We're joined by Representative Coghill.
Here I'm trying.
The E is an Eric version.
Mr. Chair, I would offer for Representative Kelly HB 186, an act declaring certain firearms and accessories to be exempt from federal regulation and as 26-LS0627-R.
Thank you. So without
R-E-E.
E is in Eric.
E is in Eric.
So without it...
I got R here.
So it's the E version. So without objection, we have the CS for House Bill 186 version. E is in Eric before us. Representative Kelly, the floor is yours. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Once again, I'm Mike Kelly, Representative District 7. And the bill you have before you, the Alaska Firearms Freedom Act, comes out of a concern in Alaska and other states about the Second Amendment rights to keep and bear arms. There's been quite a bit of action in this arena with the Supreme Court decision and the Washington D.C. Action to control guns. So it's something that has been out there quite a bit in the media, and there are a lot among the constituents in my neck of the woods that are very much in favor of taking steps to make sure that as we move forward, that as much as possible, we have defended our Second Amendment rights to keep and bear arms. This bill simply provides that firearms manufactured in Alaska and the accessories for those firearms that are made in Alaska and kept in Alaska are not subject to regulation by the federal government. And the federal government regulation now comes through two things, the Interstate Commerce Clause and then the Firearms Act, but it attaches to the Interstate Commerce Clause. So this would merely say that if we make guns in Alaska and they're used in Alaska, we'll take care of making the law to law and regulation to control those should we choose to do so. So Montana just passed the law, and I know Tennessee is in the process, moving through the process. Those are a couple of states that have been involved in this. So, Mr. Chairman, if I might have Derek Miller just walk through the technical points of the bill for you, that would be okay.
That'd be great. Now, you know that I'm a great advocate of commerce in the state of Alaska. So, is this a value-added industry that we're talking about here in the state?
Mr. Chairman, it certainly is, and that's one of the things mentioned by constituents that have talked about this, is some excitement for actually beginning to do that in the state. So at this time, with the economy in the shape it has that additional benefit.
Representative Kelly, you had me at hello. Derek, if you'll take us through the bill, I'd appreciate it. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Derek, and our staff, Representative Kelly. Section 1 of the bill is a binding section, which describes the authority of the Second, Ninth, and Tenth Amendments of the Constitution of the United States, the second being the reserving of the right of the people to keep and bear arms, the Ninth Amendment guaranteeing to the people rights not granted in the Constitution, the Tenth Amendment guaranteeing to the states and their people all powers not granted to the federal government elsewhere in the Constitution. Section 2 of the bill is the meat of the bill and basically exempts from federal regulation a personal firearm, a firearm accessory, or ammunition that is manufactured commercially or privately in this state and that remains within the borders of this state from federal law or federal regulation. It includes the registration under the authority of the United States Congress to regulate interstate commerce, as these firearms have not left the state. The firearm manufactured or sold in the state must have the words "made in Alaska" clearly stamped on a central metallic part, such as the receiver or frame. Then it also, in Section 2, our definition section of firearm accessory, generic and insignificant parts, and what the term manufactured means. And then finally, Section 3 is simply the applicability section, which applies this bill to all firearms, accessories, and ammunition manufactured and retained in the state after October 1st, 2009. And as Representative Kelly mentioned earlier, Montana just recently, last Thursday, passed the Montana Firearms Freedom Act in their legislature and has been sent to the governor. And then Tennessee also is considering this same piece of legislation. I would also like to mention that the differences between this bill and the CS, the CS before you and the original bill, is we took out a section that was the Department of Law was concerned with compelling the Attorney General to represent citizens of this state who the federal government brings suit against. And there was a separation of powers issue with that section, so we deleted that section, and we believe that alleviates some of the concern that the Department of Law has.
Now, Derek, in the spirit of this weekend, can I ask you, if these machine guns were made in Alaska, can they be sold in hotel gift shops? And two, do I need to declare a conflict of interest?
Oh, God. Mr. Ramis, I don't believe you need to declare a conflict of interest.
Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't believe I have a conflict of interest on this bill, but I do have a couple of questions. You said that we've got, Montana's just passed it and Tennessee is considering it. I'll just lay out for you, talk for a second and lay out what my concerns are. But nobody's actually had this on the books long enough for it to go through any litigation and test the constitutionality. And what worries me is I've got this fiscal note in front of me, and I realize that half of the fiscal note is irrelevant because you've taken out the section that would require the state to pick up the litigation. But another part of the fiscal note says that the bill has significant constitutional issues that would most likely arise in the context of a state citizen being charged with a crime in federal court and could result in significant litigation in both state and federal court. So what I'm worried about is that by passing this law and telling people in the state of Alaska that it's okay to manufacture, distribute, sell, buy these certain types of products, we could potentially be setting some of our citizens up. And we could end up in a case where we say, fine under state law, no problem. We think it's okay under federal law. It shouldn't have an interstate commerce problem. It shouldn't have a problem with the Firearms Act. Have the feds come in and charge these poor people who are relying on state law with a crime, imposing, you know, opening them up to pretty significant civil and criminal liabilities, and now all of a sudden we got Alaskans in jail for doing what they thought was legal, and the feds come in and say, not so much. So could you address that, and I guess I'll just open it up for what you might have to say in response. That's my concern. I don't want to open people up to problems like that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Holmes, a couple points. First of all, we've been holding this and working on this a bit because of the provision where the original bill would have essentially ordered the Attorney General to defend a private citizen. I still think that's a great idea. I'd love to get that in there, and I'd love to do it every time the Fed oversteps on all of our navigable waters, and every time they deny me access, and every time they do the other things that are clearly against the Second and Tenth Amendment.
Mr. Chairman, I think we're voting on that resolution later today.
You're right. And so I'd be right out there with the original tough language. However, we in discussions over the first draft, Mr. Chairman, with the original bill, and that was going on in other states as well, they convinced us that if we went ahead with that we would fly in the face of the separation of powers, but that without that this is a sound bill. Not their words, but this would take away that condition. Lawyers never speak that way, but affirmative. And I understand the rule in this committee, Mr. Chairman, that you don't hack lawyers, so I'm backed off on that just a little bit.
Big time rule here.
Big time.
Big
heard,
time.
Yes. So I think I was okay. I danced through that one, but
within the bounds.
I think the concern is there, like it is with any law, any law that we write, because you can't go out there and put a note out to the Supreme Court and say, how would this be, and, as you well know as a trained attorney. So, Mr. Chairman, I think we've taken away the point that was most concerning that you bring up, and I believe the bill as it stands is a sound and normal bill, where if a manufacturer went forward, and if I were he or she, I would make sure to check, you know, to have an attorney as I move down that pathway to make sure that I could do it legally, like I would with any business that I open. So because it's got gun on it, I know it makes folks nervous, but not a problem, I don't think. But can't guarantee it.
There are very few guarantees.
Jane gave me a note that the Annie Carpinetti, that the fiscal note will still be indeterminate because of possible litigation, and that it will change the narrative on the sectional for any of the members who have turned to the back of the bill. It somewhat addresses your concern. Are there other questions for the sponsor? We do have somebody in Kenai that wishes to testify on this. Representative Gatto? And we've been joined by Representative Grunberg.
My concern is more in line with the Second Amendment, which I think whenever we deal with the Second Amendment, we use the word shall not be infringed. I believe I really understand the meaning of infringed. And my concern is small, but it does say if we go ahead and we pass something that deals with intrastate possession and use of firearms, do we give a de facto admission that the feds can then turn around and say that the Second Amendment can be interpreted differently than all of we here interpreted? Is there any connection that says, boy, we think the Second Amendment could be overturned, so we're going to do this? Because I don't believe that. I hope it doesn't happen, but also don't believe it will happen. And I guess the question is that a de facto way of saying, you know, we'll give them the Second Amendment if they'll let us have this?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gatto, I think I'd throw that in the bucket if I were an attorney doing the other side. And I think were I the judge, I'd pitch it out in the brush. But that's just my opinion. But I think it's a good point, and it would certainly be brought forward, is that if you thought you had this right, why do you have to affirm it? But, Mr. Chairman, I would submit we're doing a bit of that lately, and it may be in order. And this is one way to say what this does is allow us to regulate firearms manufactured in Alaska. Mm-hmm. So it goes beyond just saying we have the right to the Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms. Mm-hmm. We really don't argue that in here. We just say we get this idea of making guns in Alaska, and if we do, we'll take care of regulating them until they cross that Canadian border and on the south end. So it I think we're okay there, but cannot guarantee it.
Well, from my end, we see so much encroachment from the federal government and find ourselves on defense so often. I'm glad to see our elbows out on an issue trying to expand the envelope of what we're allowed to do. So I'm delighted with this bill, even with the questionable constitutional concerns that it carries with it. I'd like to see us challenge the feds. Are there other questions for members? Representative Grunberg, and then we're going to go to testimony out at Kenai.
Oh, I can either wait. Let me,
go ahead.
As long as Representative Kelly is here. Paragraph number 4, lines 11 to 17, page 2. Your staff might want to take a look at an amendment to that because of the recent D.C. decision on the D.C. gun ban law by the U.S. Supreme Court. I actually think that you can make that stronger because that case did give a personal right to bear arms, and I think you should update that and not focus back on the time Alaska was admitted to the Union. That's now got separate constitutional underpinnings. That's number one. Number two, I'm sorry, I was a few minutes late here. It seems to me that there are two separate constitutional issues, very serious ones, both the Supremacy Clause and the Interstate Commerce Clause. This seems to address the Supremacy Clause, but does, I'm sorry, the Interstate Commerce Clause, but it doesn't go into the fact the Interstate Commerce Clause to the extent of the various federal laws and whether individual federal laws may preempt the states in this area. And the third point I'd like to make is that the Interstate Commerce Clause has been read very, very broadly in case, and it involved a diner somewhere in Georgia that was strictly serving people along a roadway, that the federal government could regulate that, at least in the area of equal protection, segregation, integration issues. And you might want to take a look at that. Did you discuss whether the Tennessee law has been enacted?
Ms. Chairman, Representative Grunberg, the Montana law is passed. To our knowledge, the Tennessee law is not passed yet.
So Montana is the only state that's done this?
Yes, they just did it last days ago.
Through the chair, have you looked into the costs of defense of this?
Representative Grunberg, we discussed before you arrived that Annie Carpinetti has issued an indeterminate fiscal note based on the likelihood of a constitutional challenge.
Because I have a research paper here on a different law, it's the cost of defending unconstitutional laws. I'll have this distributed. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Derek?
Representative Grunberg, through the chair, I haven't had a chance to take a close look at the past, but I will look at it. I believe they might have language reference in the D.C. gun ban reference. Look at it.
Through the chair, the only bill you have in here is the Tennessee. I didn't see the Montana.
Okay. Any questions for the sponsor? Let's go to Scott Heyman in Kenai. Scott, are you with us this morning? Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you this morning. My name is Scott Hammond. My post office box is 934 Kenai. I really appreciate this piece of legislation. I think it's a great thing, and it's about time the state of Alaska starts sticking up for us people out here and reclaiming our rights underneath the 10th and 9th Amendment of the Constitution. I think this is really a well-written piece, and I would also say that I think it really is the business of the state of Alaska to protect its citizens from abusive powers that the federal government seemed to be trying to put on us. And I again strongly support it and urge you to pass this out of committee. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions for Scott Heyman this morning?
Yes.
Scott, we thank you for getting up so early to offer testimony. Also in the room there with you, I think, is Steve Catalano. Steve, are you there?
I am. Good morning.
Good morning. If you introduce yourself for the record and any affiliation.
Yes, I'm Steve Catalano. My address is P.O. Box 1626 Kenai. I agree wholeheartedly with Mr. Hammond. This bill speaks directly to my pursuit of happiness. And I really would like to see the state support me in that endeavor. It's about time that the states start to stand up and support their citizens and what their interpretation of is of their pursuit of happiness. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions for Mr. Catalano? Thank you. Is there anybody else online or in the room that wishes to testify on the Alaska Firearms Freedom Act? Nobody else online? All right, we're going to close public testimony on this bill. Representative Holmes.
I've been sort of talking offline with Jane about whether or not we have anybody from Department of Law, and I believe they may be trying to get somebody to address a few questions.
Okay, we'll just take a brief at ease. We want to keep things moving because we're aware of the final weeks. I want to have the opportunity to vote on and to move this bill from committee this morning. But in deference to Representative Holmes, we're going to set this bill aside. We're going to wait till somebody from the Department of Law is available. We're going to read into the record this amendment language from HB 193. We're going to take up House Bill 36 at such time that the Department of Law is available. We will ask Representative Johansson to step aside so we can bring the Department of Law in, finish our committee discussion, and let Representative Kelly get back to the important business of finance in the waning days. Is that acceptable to you, Representative Holmes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
That's convenient for you,
yes.
Representative Kelly.
Yes, Mr.
And we hope that you'll be accommodating of that, Representative Johansson. So that's our plan, so you'll let us know as soon as Department of Law is available, and I apologize for handling this in a fractured manner, but it seems like it keeps the freight moving. All right, our next piece of business as we set House Bill 186 aside is Representative Gruenberg, Jane Pearson has asked me to read into the record some language regarding a conceptual amendment that was added in House Bill 193, and we wanted to wait until you were in the room. I want to read that into the record now. Susan, you're okay with that?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
May I just inquire?
Yes.
I think, why don't we just make this letter part of the record? Say,
thank you for helping me. I think I was just real explicit on what we're going to do.
Okay, because I was curious, is this one change or two changes?
This is a single change.
A single change.
Mm-hmm.
So that goes out.
Yes.
And then this comes in. Okay, please go. I don't have any objection.
Thank you. I'm going to read this into the record then. This is I'm not sure which amendment number it was. This isn't, you'll be able to link that up. This is AS24.60.060A, a legislator, legislative employee, or a public member of the committee may not knowingly make an unauthorized disclosure of information that is made confidential by law, that the person acquired in the course of official duties. A person who violates this section is subject to a proceeding under AS24.601.170 and may be subject to prosecution under AS11.56.860 or another law. It was amendment number four.
Conceptual.
And it was a conceptual amendment. Is that language acceptable to the members, Representative Gruenberg?
I think there's a typo on this. Second line from the bottom of the proposed new language. 601 should be something else, but with that, I would make a motion that we accept this change.
That's true, actually. There should only be two digits in that part of the statute.
Okay. All right, so with that notation made, it doesn't require a motion. It just requires the consent of the members. So with that, it has the consent of the members. So we will set the language for HB 193 aside. Thank the members for their help on that. Have we heard from the Department of Law? Just take just a moment if we can keep things in. Just go off the record for just a moment. Record, it's 8:35. We're going to take up House Bill 36, and when we hear from somebody in the Department of Law, I think that we'll be able to move through 186 swiftly. With that, we will move to House Bill 36. We are delighted to have the sponsor, Representative Johansson, here along with Sonia. And we have public testimony and folks that wish to testify. And I will let members know that we have folks from elections, folks from the Lieutenant Governor's office, as well as the State Chamber, the Alliance, and the Resource Development Council, and a couple of individuals who wish to testify on this bill as we turn to committee discussion. We will allow for an introduction by the sponsor, and then before we begin taking questions, we'll check with the Department of Law to see whether they're, whether they have their act together. And then we will resume this with the intent of pushing as far through this piece of legislation as we can today, again, because we're mindful of the clock. With that, Representative Johansson, welcome to House Judiciary. It's your first visit here this year. We're very happy to have you. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate your prompt scheduling of this bill after our request last week. And for your planning purposes, if it helps, I am required to be at the press availability at 9, so I'm naturally going to get out of the room about 8:55, if that helps in your planning purposes. Mr. Chairman, committee members, House Bill 36 will be familiar to at least five of you at the table. It's very similar to the legislation that was introduced last year and passed out of this committee, and it has to do with the disclosure of the money that is injected into the initiative process and also to the statewide discussion and information dissemination on ballot initiatives throughout the state. So just very briefly, the idea behind this legislation was to push back the disclosure timeline as close to the beginning of the process as possible, to find out from the very beginning of the initiative process who is contributing money to putting a question on the ballot that enacts state law, and that all of our citizens are required to live under that statutory framework. So to find out if there's money going into any attempt at changing the Alaska statutes that Alaskans are required to live under. So this bill would require that we know when the money is spent during the signature gathering process. So generally that's point number one. Point number two is to provide a mechanism for folks around the state to be educated about what is in an initiative, what the sponsors are putting out there on the initiative prior to it being certified by the Lieutenant Governor and ending up, as we've all seen with initiatives, basically a public relations battle on the TV, the radio, and in the newspaper. The effort is to have a formal process for the information to get out to the people. Now, in the bill, there are two different ways to achieve that. One is to require that there be public meetings held around the state to talk about what is in the initiative. The second part, which I think is very important also, is to have a process where state departments that will be affected by an initiative have the opportunity to reflect publicly about how that will impact their day-to-day operations and how it fits into what their charge is under the statutes and under the Constitution. So basically, in general, it's disclosure and it's education for the voters. And with the indulgence of the chair, if we can quickly go through each section, would that be okay with the chairman?
Absolutely, and I do have a note that Sue McLean from the Department of Law is on her way over here, so we'll go until 9 o'clock and then take a break if she's in the room and finish up what we're doing at 186 and then come back to this. We're happy to go through the sections, you bet.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to ask Sonia Christensen, who's been working on this bill for the last couple years, to go through basically what each section does, And I'll follow up very briefly with my reasoning for going down the path of each section. So if Sonia can go through, starting with Section 1.
For the record, Sonia Christensen, staff to Representative Johansson. Starting with Section 1, what this does is it pushes back the disclosure, the times when groups have to disclose, from after language is certified on the ballot to as soon as they file their language with the Lieutenant Governor's office, they would have to begin financial disclosures.
Mr. Chairman, can I ask a quick question on timing?
Sure, Representative Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just since I've never actually done an initiative, the timing of this is that they, I know that there's a pre-book that you get where you have to get like 100 signatures. Do you go to the Lieutenant Governor's office first and get and submit the language, then do the 100? Can you walk me through really quickly the timeline on this and where in that timeline this would kick in?
Through the chair, Representative Holmes, how it works is a group would file their language accompanied by $100 fee and 100 signatures of registered voters in Alaska. From then on, the Lieutenant Governor's office has, I believe, 60 days to review the language and determine its constitutional issues, if any. And then they have to either print the booklets that go statewide to gather the signatures or deny the petition.
Okay. Thank you.
And on Section 1, that is the one of the real main issues of the bill is to, from that early portion of the process, to immediately find out when money gets into the system that would pay for whatever you have to do as the process goes to get it on the ballot. So pushing back as far back as possible to find out when money enters into the system and begins to fund an attempt to change state statute through the initiative process.
So, Mr. Chairman, if I could ask one.
Representative Holmes?
So this doesn't change the type of people who report, it just changes the time at which they start reporting, is that correct?
Yeah, through the chair, it simply moves the timeline of when you start to report as close to the beginning as possible, so we know from the onset when money goes into the system and who's putting the money in the system.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Gatto and then Greenberg.
Thank you. I'm looking at Section 1 and Section 1 of the sectional, which says for the principal purpose of influencing a bill proposed for inclusion, etc. For the purpose of influencing, which indicates to me either up or down. You can influence a bill by supporting it or opposing it. But when I go to page 1 of the sponsor substitute for the bill, I'm looking at line 8, organized for the principal purpose of filing an initiative proposal. Sounds like that applies to people that support the initiative, but not to people that oppose the initiative. So I'm having trouble making the sectional connect with the language in the bill.
Through the chair, if the bill needs to be amended, and that's what this process is for, the intent is to have every dollar, whether you're opposed or against any question, to be out there publicly so we know who's opposing it, who's supporting it. I don't really care. I just want to make sure everybody knows who's spending money on either side of the issue. It's irrelevant to me what the question is or who supports it. And we can certainly reflect this off of the folks across the street and see if we can resolve that.
Oh, Representative Grunberg, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In response to the last exchange, I think it's very clear from this that it works either way. If you look at lines 2 and 3, influencing the outcome, that would be either pro or con. I don't think you need to change that, and I think that's very clear from the current language. But since we're going numerically through this, Mr. Chair, I'd like to go back to the title. Would you have any objection that if the bill does pass out of committee that we narrow the title to whatever it should be? This is just, I think, too broad a title. Would you have any problem with narrowing the title to whatever we do?
As long as it
through the chair, stays with the intent of myself, the sponsor, to disclose every dollar and to allow for the information dissemination. Frankly, the title could be 12 pages if you'd like.
I just want to be sure that it accurately reflects what we've done, but it doesn't become a vehicle for all kinds of stuff we haven't looked at.
We certainly open for discussion.
Thank you.
Sonia?
Section 2. Section 2 is conforming language with Section 1. It's requiring just bumping that disclosure deadline back to as soon as the initiative is filed. This is the same with Section 3, 4, excuse me, 3. Section 4 basically removes an initiative from the grouping of initiative, referendum, and recall, so we can apply specific disclosure requirements just to the initiative process.
May I inquire?
Representative Grimberg?
Is Section 4 simply conforming law to the changes really made in Sections 1 through 3? I'm asking this to Ms. Christensen. Or is Section 4 something different? I didn't really understand if it related to the first three sections.
Section 4 is its own section, basically removing initiative from the grouping of initiative, referendum, and recall. It's not conforming language with 1, 2, 3.
I don't understand.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Johansson.
Thank you. Representative Grunberg, Section 4, as it's listed, it lists initiatives, referendums, recalls. And the deletion of an initiative in Section 4, that deletion is expanded on in Section 5. So we take initiative out of that list and make it more specific to what we're trying to do. And Section 5 follows with the more specific intent that we're trying to get to. So it takes it out of the list and expands upon what we're trying to do.
Then I'll wait for the explanation on Section 5, but I do have a question about that.
We were joined some time ago by Representative Millett. I'm not sure if she's still in the room or not. Okay, Sonia, continue, please.
Section 5 applies specific disclosure requirements to the initiative process. It basically says that if you contribute $500 or more, or if a group is organized and spends $500 or more, they have to start disclosing.
May I inquire?
Representative Grunberg.
I read this, and when I read this, I looked at subsection 1, capital B. It didn't make any sense. It just grammatically didn't make any sense, and I'll read it. This subsection applies to an initiative committee, et cetera, a committee, et cetera, receiving contributions exceeding 500 or making expenditures exceeding 500 in a calendar year in support of or opposition to require a report by a person. I'm sorry. That's not even right. This subsection applies to require a report by a person identified in one of this subsection. Grammatically, that doesn't make any sense. If you look at, it goes from line 27, this subsection applies to, then it goes over to line 3, require a report. Grammatically, that just didn't make any sense to me. And I think there must be a misprint.
I think that's probably a drafting error, and we will work on that as we work through this piece of legislation.
And I don't know what your intent was, if I may.
I'm sure it's noted by the sponsor.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, Sonia.
Section 6 and Section 7 change the definition. Section 6 changes the definition of contribution to include those contributions made in support of or opposition to initiative proposals filed with the Lieutenant Governor, which means basically as soon as they're filed. There's some language that has moved from a subsection up to Section A, which is just a drafter's alignment. Section 7 changes the definition of expenditure to include those expenditures that are spent in support or opposition to initiatives filed to the Lieutenant Governor's office. Section 8 restricts initiatives to be filed if they have failed in the previous election.
And Sonia, do you think Section 8 is constitutional?
Chairman.
Representative Johansson.
Repeat the question, please. I didn't.
I said, do you think Section 8 is constitutional?
Mr. Chairman, Section 8, there is a question on Section 8 as it bumps up against the Constitution, and I think we realize that may be a challenge. In other states, it is allowed, and I believe the court cases have supported that the language in their constitutions was a bit different than our Constitution. And that is one of the sections that I would rely on the conversations at this Judiciary Committee in its purview to decide. I'm not at all wed to this language. If I could have it my way, that's the way it would be, but I would lay it on the table to the Judiciary Committee to discuss that. I do realize it bumps up very close to the Constitution. We rely on your leadership.
And I will swing that challenge back to you. Our plan for this afternoon, because Representative Dahlstrom is not here, is going to be to take up the amendments for the death penalty bill, but not have a final vote on the bill until the full committee is together. And so if we have time left beyond amendments this afternoon, I'd like to continue to do committee work on House Bill 36. So I would ask you as the sponsor between 10 a.m. and when we reconvene sometime this afternoon, if you can work on sections of this bill that you said bump up against the Constitution. So if that's the euphemism that we want to go with, I would strongly suggest to the sponsor to contemplate what kind of a language substitute you would want for the sections that bump up against the Constitution and contemplate deleting them from the bill, or recommend language changes so that we can expedite the movement of this bill through the committee, which is the chair's desire. But since the integrity and the credibility of the House Judiciary Committee rests on our instruction not to have issues that bump up against the Constitution leave the committee room, we would be grateful for a very thoughtful purge between now and 1 p.m. So with that, we appreciate your thoughts on Section 8. Representative Lynn?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. On Section 8, if this is a good provision, as you must think it is, what about bills that we sponsor? If they don't make it through the legislature, should we be prohibited from introducing a substantially similar bill in the next session or the next session?
I don't mind.
I would have hoped not.
Well,
we could have a 10-day session.
That's my point. That's my point, precisely, because it's the same thing.
And I think the chairman indicated that would be a good conversation when he goes back to these sections and discuss them thoroughly. So.
I'm trying hard to like this bill. I'm trying hard. I'm a big fan of direct democracy, but I'm trying hard. Okay, Sonia, Red, have at it.
Section 9 requires signature gatherers to carry a copy of the entire bill. Right now, if it's more than 500 words, they carry a summary, but it's important that they carry the entire bill.
And that's absolutely important.
Representative Johansson?
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sorry. Through the full information, summaries, as we all know, will be written in a way that may focus on certain aspects of an initiative and may simply gloss over other aspects. And I think that every citizen, upon request, should be able to have a full copy of the language at every signature gathering post in the state. Thank you.
Section 10 prohibits per signature commission for signature gatherers. It does not prohibit payment per se, just one form of payment. you can still receive bonuses or an hourly wage, but just not a first signature commission.
Representative Holmes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Have we had a problem with that? I mean, I understand from, I read somewhere in the sectional or the sponsor statement or somewhere that this was to avoid fraud. Have there been fraud cases in the state of Alaska?
Representative Holmes?
On
that point, I didn't mean to interrupt you, I'm sorry.
Oh, I was going to say I was wondering whether there have been fraud cases in the state of Alaska based on the dollar per signature.
On my first year in the legislature, we did that comprehensive elections bill through state affairs, and I did that with Representative Lynn and Representative Grinberg and Representative Gatto. And
were you on that too?
Not that year. And I actually introduced an amendment to delete the dollar per signature with Lieutenant Governor Lehman, and it was thrown out at that time because a payment is a guaranteed whatever. And so there have not been fraud problems in the state of Alaska with this, but since then states have innovated other forms of payment. And I think that's what the sponsor is relying on, is a different payment mechanism. Is that right, Sonia? Or Representative Johansson?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. And you're correct. I'm not sure, obviously, as we all know, staff does most of the research. Sonia may have specific instances in Alaska, but this section is based on what has happened in other states. Law in other states had per signature gathering with more experience than we have, and they have found that fraud has worked its way into the system. And subsequently, many of the states have reverted back away from per signature gathering, and Sony has good examples of why they've done that. We've done the research on the minutes and the legislation in other states. So, not sure if it's happened here or not. I would guess probably. Has it been documented? I'm not sure. But to be ahead of the curve and following the example of other states, we think it's prudent to step out and do this. And this, as Sonia mentioned, this does not restrict discretionary bonuses based on circulators' reliability, longevity, and productivity. There is a way, if you have a great signature gatherer who does a good job and works hard at it, you know, there's a mechanism for keeping somebody that's good. But on the, you know, simply going out and getting as many signatures as possible, we have found fraud in other states, and we wanna stop that before it starts. Mr. Chairman, I apologize. I need to run upstairs. Sonia knows this better than I do, so I'm going to take off. I apologize.
Yeah.
We'll be ready this afternoon.
Right.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
This was one of the sections that I was well aware of the lengthy discussion we had on this provision, whatever it was, 6 years ago in the State Affairs Committee. And it resulted with the discussion with Representative Ramirez, and we did not pass that provision out at the time. In order for me to be convinced that we should change the law, what I'm going to need is a little more documentation as to a couple of things. Number one, the problems that have occurred in other states. And secondly, whether a change like this in the law would make it more difficult to get people to carry petitions professionally. Because I know that one of the difficult things of getting an initiative on the ballot is that you usually have to pay people to gather the signatures. That's just, we can't rely on for people to do it. And I support the initiative, but I'm also cognizant of the realities. And so what I'm interested in is whether this has chilled the initiative in those states that have gone this route. Through the chair, could you answer those two questions, please, Ms. Christian?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, in your packet, I included an article from NCSL that talked about some of the problems that other states have incurred For example, some of them place carbon paper below an initiative petition, and it copies some of the personal information that can then be copied to another initiative that they weren't explained, that they didn't necessarily pledge their support to. Another example is an initiative petition gatherer saying that you have to sign three places to show your support, when it's actually you're signing three different petitions. Mm. And there's quite a few other examples, but that is one that's included in your packet.
How about this one specifically?
Has it chilled the initiative process?
Well, now, okay, let me make sure that you understand my question.
Representative Grunberg.
I'm only focusing on this one section, not carbon paper or anything like that. We can talk about that separately. But this particular thing is apparently, according to Representative Johansson, designed to cure a problem that has occurred in other states because of the paying of a dollar a signature. Tell me where that problem has occurred, what it is, and why this will cure the problem.
Other states, their rationale would be that if petition gatherers were paid hourly or were not paid on a per signature basis, they would be more apt to maybe take more time to explain issues to folks, or they might not be, basically they would take more time. They wouldn't be as maybe aggressive in gathering signatures. Now, I don't know the answer to your question if it has put a damper on that, but I could find out for you.
I would appreciate it. I'm not being negative on this particularly. I just need to know what the current situation is. I know the passion that the chair feels for this, and obviously your boss feels the same, and I just need to know a little bit more about it. It's kind of a standalone provision.
Thank you. And to that end, I sat next to former Representative Eric Croft, who was collecting signatures on an initiative that I opposed very aggressively, which was the reserves tax, while I was collecting signatures for the 90 days. So I had the opportunity of collecting over 5,000 signatures myself, probably asking 10,000 people in the process of collecting those signatures. I probably collected more than 5,000 all across the corners of the state, and was able to audit the process perhaps more closely than any member in this room. And I was quite satisfied that there was no fraud, that certainly were unregistered voters who signed petitions, but that's precisely the vetting process of the Division of Elections. And approximately, I think, in the Reserves Tax Initiative and in the 90-Day Initiative, about 81% of the signatures were accepted by the Division of Elections. And frankly, I think they are the heroes in this process in protecting the Direct Democracy Initiative. And I'm a big fan of the way that they conduct themselves. When we come back to the committee for discussion, I will offer a lot of firsthand observations and going through the process. Sonia, I'm going to ask you to freeze in your presentation right there. I thought I saw Annie come back into the room.
Yeah, she's here.
Is she here? Mm-hmm. So Annie, if you will come back up before us so that we can work our way through House Bill 186, so we can let Representative Kelly get back to his work. Representative Grunberg, we're on to 186. Let me just be the chair just for 5 minutes.
I just wanted her to think about it.
I know you do. You want to? Annie, so happy to see you.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Annie Carpinetti, and I represent the Criminal Division of the Department of Law.
Thank you. Annie, Representative Holmes has some questions for you on House Bill 186.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do. Good morning.
Good morning. May I say one thing before I answer, or I try to answer questions, is that we do not have a position on this bill, and we have not had a chance to study it to the extent that that it should be studied in order to give a reliable opinion. So I am probably not going to be able to answer any difficult questions because we simply haven't had the chance to do so. And we realize that there are issues raised in this bill, but we haven't done the research to come to a conclusion.
Okay.
Well, with the chair's indulgence, I'll go ahead and ask them anyway, and you can answer them or not to the best of your ability. Here's my concern, as I laid it out to the bill sponsor earlier. We have, I understand, Montana has passed a similar law, we've been told by the bill sponsor, and Tennessee is considering one, but no bill has been on the books for very long enough to go through any sort of legal challenge. So what I'm afraid is going to happen with this bill is that we would pass a law that would say it's okay to manufacture, distribute, sell, buy certain products within this state. The feds will come in, prosecute, probably criminally, Alaska citizens for doing what they thought was legal under Alaska law. I'm afraid in particular about interstate commerce and supremacy clause issues with the bill. And that we're basically setting our citizens up with this bill by telling them that certain activities are okay, and then having them rely on that, and then have the feds come in and tell them differently. And I'm just really worried, far more than with any substantive issues in this bill, that we could be putting Alaskans in great danger for criminal and civil liability. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, through the chair, Representative Holmes, those are the issues that we are concerned with, too, whether or not the state can exempt itself from the Commerce Clause under these circumstances. And that's one of the questions that we have not come to a resolution of yet.
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm also concerned about other possible challenges, because there are federal regulations as to the specifications and the care with which weapons must be manufactured. And with this might also spawn civil litigation by national gun manufacturers who could say that Alaskan guns are manufactured not to their specifications, and unfair competition, this sort of thing. Has the Department of Law considered not just the effect of litigation from a criminal point of view, but from the civil division as well?
Through the chair, I have not discussed that with the civil division, but that's an issue that should be considered. We simply have not done so.
That's all right, Annie, I mean, you can't open a restaurant just because you're afraid it's going to fail. What if people who eat don't like your, you know, don't like your food don't show up? I mean, I see the DEC roll in with new regulations all the time. I mean, you can't not open a restaurant for fear the DEC is going to change the rules and make it more cumbersome. I mean, with all due respect, state government does that to me all the time. What's the difference?
With passing a law like this and opening a restaurant?
That's an interesting linkage, but yeah, I'll roll with that, sure.
A law like this affects all of our citizens, and maybe a restaurant affects only the citizens in the area where you open it.
I think my interest is more for the risk that accrues to the owner of a restaurant, in the same way that the person who acquires all the parts and pieces to assemble and make machine guns with the Made in Alaska stamp. And we haven't gotten into whether, if these are made by rural Alaskans, whether they would enjoy the silver hand or not, which is a different issue. Perhaps we can hear from the bill sponsor on that.
The Lone Ranger.
Yeah.
Silver bullets.
My concern is you just can't wait to see what happens. You take your chances in the marketplace, I think that's reasonable. How long would a constitutional challenge take to mount? In this case, this isn't an election doesn't hinge on it. It doesn't have a short fuse in the way that some other pressing issues does. How long is a court challenge likely to take to make its way through the court system?
Well, as I imagine this coming up, it would be a prosecution of somebody for violation of the federal firearms statute, and that individual challenging the constitutionality of it based on what arguments he or she brings, including the Alaska.
And would that court challenge go up through the state Supreme Court, or would it be held over into the federal court?
I would imagine it would be held in federal court.
So a guy could probably make machine guns for a few years before the court decided on his outcome.
I would imagine such a challenge would take more than a year at least.
I'd say we've created a market. All right, are there other questions for Ms. Carpinetti?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Cohen.
Just a curiosity in looking at this bill. A company named Winchester makes firearms. And under the terms of this bill, could a company like Winchester come up here and make the exact same firearm, but make it with locally produced parts? Would that be in violation of the intent of the federal government there?
Government?
I mean, this bill is only effective if indeed we have some restrictions on the federal level. Otherwise, we don't need this. So let's say restrictions on the federal level occur, and you have to satisfy all the rules, and the rules prohibit Winchester from manufacturing certain kinds of weapons, and the certain kind of weapon then comes up here and is manufactured here by the same company name, making the same exact weapon that they intended to prohibit. And you can call it an assault rifle, you can call it a machine gun, some thing that the federal government wants us not to do, and then we come up here and do it. And I pick Winchester because I'm trying to get the connection with the exact same product. Would this bill then allow us to make the exact same product, even with a company name, as long as it was made here?
Through the chair, I would think that a corporation that's registered and doing business in various parts of the country would be a factor that would weigh in on the litigation in a way that would probably not be helpful to upholding this law.
So we need different names.
That's just, yeah.
Right. Other questions for Ms. Carpinetti? Representative Gruenberg?
Yes, Ms. Carpinetti, this would exempt certain weapons from federal regulation. Do you see that any litigation that would result from, now I presume the way this would arise would be that somebody would be prosecuted in federal court for a violation of federal law, and this would be raised as an affirmative defense. Is that the way you see this would actually work?
Through the chair, I that's what my imagination says. Well, we were basing it on state law. That's what a litigant would probably raise.
And if that were the case, let us say that you were prosecuting me, you're now a federal prosecutor.
No.
And I raise a defense that this was manufactured in Alaska. How would that, as a practical matter, be proven?
Through the chair, I would have to put myself in your shoes then, wouldn't I, as a litigant, to establish that evidence? And I would, you know, this is wild speculation on my part, but as long as we're speculating, I would say you would have to show where you got the materials that you put together. I that's my guess.
Thank you.
Are there other questions for Ms. Carpinetti? Representative Holmes, any more questions for Ms. Carpinetti?
No, thank you.
Okay. Any? Thank you. All right. We have this bill back before the committee. Are there any amendments to be offered? We've already closed public. Representative Gatto.
Yes. Thanks, Mr. Chair. On page 2, line 2, the word is understood, and on same page, line 12, the word understood, and I'm going to make a conceptual amendment to delete understood and substitute intended.
Okay.
Or, since it's conceptual, I'm actually searching for an even better term.
Okay.
But I think it has more clout and is more descriptive of what we're after.
Okay, I'm going to object for the purpose of discussion. Representative Kelly, would you comment on Representative Gatto's proposed conceptual amendment number one?
That was on page two.
Page two, line 12, the word "understood" is going to be...
And line two as well.
Okay.
You said lines two and line 12.
Lines two and line 12, okay.
And if I got to all of the bills, we'll make it conceptual.
Okay. So it's a conforming amendment, conforming conceptual amendment to, is that right, or just these two references?
To any place in the bill where it might show up, I just...
Representative Kelly?
Here and here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't think this does any violence to the bill, so I would have no objection.
Okay. All right. Is there any more discussion on conceptual amendment number one? Okay, I'll remove my objection. Seeing no objection, conceptual amendment number one passes from committee. Are there any other items? Okay, we're going to take a brief of these. Representative Coghill. So conceptual amendment number one has passed, Representative Coghill, and House Bill 186, that has, it's a conforming amendment to change the word "understood" into the word "intended," or another word that's acceptable to the drafters that meets the intent of Representative Gatto. That amendment has been consented to by the prime sponsor, Representative Kelly. There are no more amendments. The chair would entertain a motion. Representative Lynn?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move CS for House Bill number 186 as amended, 26-LS0627-E. And is there a fiscal note here?
I think it's an indeterminate fiscal note.
Indeterminate fiscal note.
Thank you. Without objection, CS, Representative Grunberg?
I'm going to object, at least for the purpose of discussion.
Okay.
And I know this is at the end of, close to the end of the session.
Yes.
And this is an important piece of legislation.
Aren't they all, Representative Grunberg?
Not like this. And we haven't really had complete vetting of the constitutional issues and legal opinions.
Okay.
And I see these being extremely significant and having far-reaching ramifications that could go well up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And this could serve as precedent for all kinds of states asking to be exempted from federal regulation on everything from firearms to mosquito spray and cosmetics and food and drug and everything else. And I think for this committee to do its work, and I'm not saying where I come out on the bill, but I think we need, this is traditionally the most thoughtful committee in the entire legislature on legal and constitutional issues. And at this point, this bill is where the rubber meets the road, and I think we need a thorough vetting of those constitutional issues by people who are really studied and knowledgeable. And I'm not seeking just to delay it. I am seeking to learn about it because none of us know much about this bill.
Representative Kelly?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Grunberg, I hope it catches on and causes a 50-state response. That is exactly what I would like to see. And this is a bill, Mr. Chairman, that does bump up against the Constitution. It's one of those that can't not. And so it's precisely the reason for the bill is to give a brushback pitch to the Fed that what we do in the state is our business. Under the Ninth and Tenth Amendments, you should not be overreaching in that regard, the federal government. And so it is not surprising that we still have this problem after already falling back considerably from the language that said, if in fact there is a lawsuit regarding this, our own Attorney General will defend it. In other words, taking care of the very reasons that were brought up that we may put a manufacturer at risk. Yes, we did. We did that when we fell back and said, if you violate this, you're on your own. Message is pretty clear. But it is also clear that it would be very difficult to get this bill through with that constitutional overreach on our part with the bill that says, Attorney General, you will defend it, when in fact the Attorney General's boss is not residing in the legislature. So the separation of powers is there. So I accept Representative Grunberg's concerns. This will have a chance to, if you pass it out, Mr. Chairman, for the Department of Law to see if they have legitimate constitutional concerns beyond the one that we've already addressed, but I do not expect it to be a polite bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. But the subtlety here, unless I'm mistaken, is that this brushes up against the U.S. Constitution as opposed to the state constitution. I didn't detect from Ms. Carpinetti's remarks that we are in violation of the state constitution with this. And I'm pleased to push back against the U.S. Constitution, particularly on Second Amendment issues as opposed to First Amendment issues where I have a different sensitivity. Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would just, not to challenge the chair's perfect statement there, but to say that when we bump up, we're bumping up against the federal government less than the Constitution. I think everyone in this room believes that the Constitution is absolutely clear in this regard, that we have the right to keep and bear arms. Thank you.
Well said. Representative Gatto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Along those same lines, I believe it's the federal government that keeps bumping up against the citizens, and I think this is a message that says, you know, works both directions. Thank you.
Point made. Representative Grunberg.
The reason I said what I said is, as a lawyer, what will be looked at sooner or later is the research and the care and the discussion of the policy and constitutional issues. Now, that may not be very important or it may turn out to be very significant, but the record will show that at least in this committee, there was virtually no research done. There was no discussion of the legal and constitutional underpinnings of the constitutional issues involved. And if the sponsor of the bill really wants this bill to have a chance, even a chance of succeeding, there should be very, very thorough and complete legislative record that the legislature considered each of the constitutional issues and put on the record its position in adopting this bill and maybe, if necessary, making amendments to it, and not relying on what's done or wasn't done in Montana, Tennessee, or any other state. Because they'll look at this legislative history, and mark my words, this will probably be the only committee that really would look at that and provide the record necessary to support this legislation. And if it ain't there and it ain't there now, then not much weight will be given to the consideration of the constitutional issues by the state legislature. That's a very weak record to go into court on.
Representative Grunberg, did you just denigrate the chair and its judgment in trying to move this bill from committee?
I'm just making a fact. I'm not saying whether you should or shouldn't. I am saying whether it's a good idea to have the constitutional issues completely vetted and make a record. And I would never advise my clients to go into court without the proper evidence to support their case. And this will go to court.
Thank you. Representative Lynn.
The discussion we just had is now on the record, which could make it more difficult for us if it does go to court. And maybe when we talk to our new Attorney General designee, we can posit some of those questions.
Yeah, if we want to waste time on the Second Amendment with the Attorney General, because he's the biggest advocate in the state of Alaska, so I suspect that will be a very repetitive dialogue. With that, Representative Grunberg, I will maintain the objection if you don't, as I now feel compelled to put my vote on the record. Do you wish to maintain your objection to the CS for House Bill 186?
I do.
Perfect.
For the reason.
So do I. So with that, Susan, will you please take the roll on CS for House Bill 186?
Coghill.
Yes.
Representative Gatto.
Yes.
Representative Lynn.
Yes.
Representative Grunberg.
No.
Representative Holmes.
No.
Representative Dahlstrom is not present. Representative Rammers.
Yes.
four yes, two no.
Thank you. Let the record reflect that we had a thorough discussion of House Bill 186, and for some of us, it was black and white. And we recognized that the encroachment of the federal government on many levels is never ending and never ceasing. And some of us are quite satisfied with the scope of the discussion that we had on this bill. We thank the sponsor for bringing this bill before the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee.
You're welcome, Representative Grunberg.
I just want the record to reflect that my vote was based upon what I said rather than the merits of the legislation.
Point made. Thank you. Thanks, gentlemen. Thank you, Derek. Great job. All right, Sonia, do you want to come back up? And we will continue until the 10 o'clock hour. And I believe that we were in the middle of your sectional analysis. I think we had just concluded section 10, I believe. We are on our way to section 11. And as we get to section 11, I will have the same question for you about whether section 11 is constitutional.
We were
on section 10, I think. Is that right? I'm sorry. We were on section 10, and I think Representative Grunberg had a question. It's a spirited morning for my good friend, Representative Grunberg. He had a question for the bill sponsor.
It's going to be a spirited week, Mr. Chair.
I feel you.
Ms. Christensen, you mentioned the problems of carbons as an issue that was raised in the NCSL article. Has the issue of carbons and that sort of thing been addressed in this or in current law? Because that is a real problem, and if it hasn't been addressed, it ought to be.
I believe that there is actually in section 12 of the bill, it talks about the oath that petition circulators have to sign, and they have to. Excuse me while I read.
I don't need an answer to that now, but I was going to ask Sonia that so she could be looking at it during the break here. And I, since we probably won't finish with this morning, I'd ask you to take a look. And if not, let's take a look at doing an amendment to cure that problem. That's a serious problem. It ought to be against the law in Alaska if it is.
Thank you, Representative Grunberg. Sonia?
All right. Section 11. Section 11 prohibits signature gatherers from collecting signatures for more than one petition at a time. This stems from folks who, you know, stand outside the grocery store, the bookstore, with 5-6 petitions in their hand and try to explain the issues to you and garner your support. But it also goes along with Section 10 and the fraud concerns. Is, are you signing the petition that you have agreed to pledge your support for?
Excuse me. I have to ask you. So these are registered voters that have the opportunity to sign a state ballot initiative. And so the registered voter isn't committing fraud. You're worried about the signature collector committing fraud.
Yes, sir.
There's nothing wrong with the registered voter. They're not fraudulent in their activities. The exclusive concern is whether the signature gatherer would be committing fraud.
Mm-hmm.
And so an initiative petition gatherer is collecting signatures for an idea, and we want to suggest that they can only collect signatures for one idea at a time.
Yes, sir.
So I'm just going to tell you that for me, Section 11 bumps up against the Constitution also, just because that's what signature gatherers do. And they ask registered voters, would you like to sign this initiative? And then they generally flip them over and they have a second one. I know this from a great deal of firsthand experience. Not that I collected signatures for money, but the signature gatherers, they often pick the two best ideas that they think will garner the most signatures, and they ask registered voters to sign off on these ballot initiatives, which is about as pure an exchange as you can get to when it comes to direct democracy, is having a document that's been certified by the Lieutenant Governor and asking registered voters to sign that document. And And so to ask a registered voter to sign two documents and to suggest that a signature gatherer can only do one, to me, I struggle with Section 11. Representative Gatto.
Thank you. If indeed we had two initiatives and each one was held by a different person and they were side by side, in fact, chatting with each other throughout the day, and you walked up and I walked up or anyone here walked up and there were two in front of us, that's okay as long as there are two people. But if it's one person, it's not okay. I have trouble with that too.
And to that end, I stood at the Department of Motor Vehicles many times with somebody who was collecting a reserves petition signature, which I was strongly against and spoke against and was opposed to, but not to their right to stand next to me and collect those signatures. So anyway, Section 11 is a tough one. Representative Gatto.
One more thing. Sometimes at the state fair, I would bet there's five or six, each one with a different person, separated by a given number of miles or feet, or maybe sometimes only the space of a person. Would that be, that's okay?
This is a difficult section to define as far as what kind of hypotheticals could you throw out there. So basically what the sponsor would like to stick to is one place, one time for one person.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg? Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, same thing. What I was getting at was you've got two separate booths side by side, and the guy in the first booth says, I got to go to the bathroom. Would you handle my booth? He can't allow a signature there.
On that point, you can't do that because the signature book is checked out to that individual. So that would be fraud if somebody else signed somebody else's booklet. And so in that case, that's not a good example. Representative Grunberg?
I think this is getting to the issue we just talked about a minute ago. But I'm going to call it the carbon issue. The issue you want to be sure that the person who signs knows what she's signing. And the problem is a real problem. I don't think this is the best solution. And I think we need to look at something like fraudulently getting somebody's signature, and that I think would be not too difficult to draft. It may be in the law now, I don't recall, but I'm not sure this is the way to do it. And I think some of these other sections, 12, et cetera, are just conforming to this, right?
Representative Grunberg, I'm looking at the clock and it's 9:30. I'm going to ask the sponsor to hustle through the sections. Clearly we have a lot of questions, but we do have people who've been waiting 90 minutes to testify, so I'm going to ask Sonia to hustle through the sections. Let's hold off on committee discussion because there are clearly issues. If members will simply flag a section if they have a problem with it, so the sponsor can work on it between now and this afternoon, and then we'll see if we can incorporate some public testimony in as we go through this. Sonia, go ahead.
On to Section 12, basically, already petition circulators have to sign an oath saying that they didn't pay anyone to sign the petition or they actually witnessed the signatures themselves. It also adds provisions saying that they weren't paid on a per-signature commission or that they didn't collect signatures for more than one petition at a time, which is so basically conforming language.
So if you had problems with 11, you would have problems with 12,
yes.
For instance, okay?
Yep.
Okay.
Section 13 requires public hearings in 30 House districts.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to flag that one.
Okay, so we're going to flag, some are going to flag 11 and 12, some are going to flag 13, some are going to flag 8.
And 14 will be conforming with 13, so we'll flag 14 too.
And I'm going to have questions about that.
Okay. And
Section
15 or 14? 15?
Section 13 also includes notice and publication requirements for those hearings. 14 is also conforming language. Basically, you have to prove that you held the hearings. Section 15 is conforming language as well. Section 16 allows the lieutenant governor the power to disqualify an initiative if they don't hold hearings in 30 House districts or if they don't notice them properly. 17 and 18 is a drafter's request. It is possible for initiatives to be on the special election ballot based on the timing, and that wasn't included in the current statute. Section 19 requires a standing committee of the legislature to remove or to review initiative petitions. It doesn't give the legislature any power to amend a single word on the initiative, but just an opportunity to ask questions and an opportunity for the affected agencies to come in front and in front of the legislature and voice their concerns or issues or ask questions.
Okay.
And that's it.
Perfect. Well done, Sonia. It's a,
Mr. Chair.
It's a heavy rucksack.
I just want to give notice that I'm going to ask one question on Section 17 and 18, okay, and then Sonia to take a look at this. Could we include in there in some manner municipal elections? Because there is no voter pamphlet that requires in municipal elections that ballot initiatives or measures have any kind of election pamphlet at all. And many people don't know what they're voting on in municipal elections. And there are a lot of ballot measures there.
That is something that the sponsor can look at, yeah.
I'm sorry?
That is something that the sponsor can look at.
Thank
certainly,
you.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Sonia. Thank you. We'll look forward to hearing from you this afternoon and on Wednesday as we have the opportunity to take this up. Let's go to public testimony. First up is Chip Toma. Chip, if you want to come up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be real brief. I know you're pressed for time. And
thank you.
Other people online. For the record, my name is Chip Toma, box 21884 in Juneau. And I'll confine my comments to HB 36, except to say that I've been involved in initiatives for 20 years. I have never been paid. I've never disbursed money. I've never raised money. The money thing only happens, in my instance, during the campaign itself. In the last 2006 election, the statewide initiative on cruise ships, we had $10,000. The opposition had about $2 million. All that was foreign money. That was all cruise ship money. The initiative last year on the mining initiative, I think $10 million of that was foreign money. $2 million of that was U.S. money from Alaskans, so I wanted to bring that to your attention. The only thing I'll mention today is Section 13. I think Section 13 in the bill, I think it's on page 5, is punitive. It's a poison pill. If a group does not hold these meetings and these notices and do it at the exact right way, the entire initiative gets thrown out. I mean, that's extremely punitive. I think we should be looking more toward ballot access rather than trying to bump initiatives out for kind of silly things like this. One way to fix this, if you really do want to have informational meetings, is let the Department of Elections pay for them, or the Lieutenant Governor's Office. That would be a wonderful thing for the Lieutenant Governor to do, is hold these public meetings and discuss these initiatives in each of 30 or 40 districts. Now, I think you will see that the price is quite prohibitive to do that. And I don't think that that onus should be put on the sponsors. If I'm going to do an initiative and it's going to cost me virtually nothing to get volunteers to go out and collect signatures, I can't afford to spend $20,000 or $30,000 holding public hearings. So I think, Lieutenant Governor, if it is a valid initiative, it is on the ballot, or it's going to be on the ballot, that maybe the Lieutenant Governor ought to hold those hearings.
Thank you. Are there questions for Mr. Toma?
Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony this morning. Wayne, can you come up and offer your thoughts, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Wayne Stevens, President and CEO of the Alaska State Chamber of Commerce.
We're happy to see you.
Thank you for the opportunity. Alaska's initiative process is increasingly being used to drive up the cost of doing business in the state, and in some cases, to attempt to stop industries from operating at all. While the functional initiative process is important in order to give citizens an opportunity to directly petition their government, Alaska's current system is opaque and susceptible to abuse. For example, individuals and groups involved in campaigning for or against an initiative are not required to provide financial disclosure online. The public may be deprived of critical information on election day, as hard copy reporting of last-minute donation and expenditures is typically not available until after the election. This lack of transparency makes it impossible for the public to accurately analyze the interests making arguments for or against any particular initiative. In recent years, Alaska's resource-based industries have been targets of numerous punitive ballot initiatives. The oil and gas industry faced an onerous and counterproductive natural gas reserves tax. The cruise ship industry was struck with a passenger head tax and new regulatory standards that are not applied to any other discharger in Alaska. and most recently the mining industry, battled an ambiguous initiative financed by undisclosed sources, which many thought was designed to shut down industry in Alaska. A more transparent and public process would help ensure the public was well-informed prior to voting on a ballot initiative, thereby lowering the risk of unintended consequences when poorly understood ballot initiatives are passed. The Alaska State Chamber of Commerce encourages the Alaska Legislature to pass legislation that, at a minimum, establishes a streamlined financial disclosure system, including disclosure of the first dollar spent or collected, prior to initiative being formally certified for the ballot, and online filing so the Alaskans can follow the money from the beginning and access important information prior to the election. Secondly, an opportunity for meaningful public involvement and vetting of proposed initiatives to increase awareness and ensure the public is well-informed prior to voting, e.g. the required public hearings in a majority of election districts prior to petition certification. The cost of initiative drafting, certifying, and campaigning would likely increase if the recommended action is taken. Such a scenario may be a double-edged sword for the business community, depending on whether the business was an initiative sponsor or opponent. However, a well-informed public is less likely to pass poorly drafted initiatives, less likely to produce unintended consequences, which could mean significant savings to business in the long run. Alaska State Chamber urges the legislature to adopt sponsor substitute for House Bill 36 that makes drafting, signature gathering, and financing of ballot initiatives more transparent for all Alaskans. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Wayne. Are there any questions for Wayne? Representative Gatto?
Thank you. Hypothetically, if we struck all the language from this bill except the language that indicated you have to tell us where the money's coming from, would you feel that that would be sufficient?
It would be a first step in the right direction, certainly.
Okay.
I won't speak for the sponsor or the intent of the bill, but...
Well, it's a question for you. You're the one that submitted the letter. You're the one that is here testifying. The question is specifically for you as a supporter of the bill. So you're okay with making sure that we do that part. Is there any other part of the bill that is difficult for you to not also support? I mean, it's too tough a question. I'm going to withdraw the question. I think it's just too involved for.
Thank you very much, Representative Gatto. We appreciate that, but I think you may have captured the spirit of the room on that one. Representative Holmes and then Lynn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And my first part of my question was the one that was just asked by Representative Gatto. The other half is on this public meeting issue. 30 out of 40 House districts, and I know that conforms with where you have to get the signatures from. You have to get a certain number of signatures out of those. But I'm just thinking about this, and I'm thinking about the expense, regardless of, aside from who bears the expense, which is another question. But that would mean that you'd have to have two separate meetings in Juneau, 25 or 30 separate meetings in Anchorage and the Mat-Su, as opposed to having, you know, one or two Anchorage meetings, one Mat-Su meeting, one Juneau meeting. Does that seem like that sort of seems duplicative and kind of overly expensive to me. Do you have a thought on that?
Well, I think the closer you can get to people's residences where you hold meetings, the easier it is for people to attend. There are meetings that go on around this state on a weekly basis, whether it's for the school board, the assembly, the council, planning and zoning commission, where decisions are made on people's future that have great impact on their day-to-day lives and existence, and the room sits empty. So certainly holding additional meetings seems to be extra work and extra expense, but I think the intent, as I understand it, is to make sure people understand, have the opportunity to question the presenters and make sure everyone is truly cognizant of the impacts, the costs, and the outcomes of the requested ballot initiative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for coming in today. Would you be opposed to an amendment to this bill that would prohibit foreign contributions to initiatives in the state? After all, as a candidate, I can't receive contributions from foreign entities. So if we as candidates can't get, private candidates can't get contributions from foreigners, how come initiative sponsors can?
Representative Lynn, through the chair, You're asking me questions beyond my skill and ability. I'm a generalist, not a specialist. You know, certainly there could be arguments made to both sides of that equation. You know, we're talking about constitutional issues and you know, all of the related parts of that, and I am not of the legal profession, so I don't know that I could accurately respond to your your question.
Well, just one follow-up. Would you be opposed to such an amendment?
Go ahead.
Through the chair, Representative Lynn, I am not a constitutional lawyer, and so I don't know the ability of an individual to contribute to contributions or make contributions to a campaign across national boundaries or across state boundaries.
Thank you. Two things, Wayne. One, the Division of Elections is here to assist Representative Lynn in answering that question. And then the second question, one that I think you are quite capable of answering, and I would appreciate a direct response to the chair. What are the chances for the Boston Red Sox this year?
The what?
Boston Red Sox.
You are wearing a Boston Red Sox tie. True or false, Mr. Stevens?
Mr. Chair, those of us who are true Red Sox fans believe every year is this year.
Thank you. Are there any additional questions for Mr. Stevens?
Yeah, Mr. Stevens, if I may, through the chair.
For those behind Mr. Stevens, he is wearing a Boston Red Sox tie, just for the record.
And today is opening season.
And today is opening day, although the game's been canceled.
Thank you, and we do wish you well in the Sox. You may recall my questioning to Ms. Christensen. You have a copy of the bill, sponsor substitute here, sir.
That is version E?
Right. Yeah, look at page 8 on the election pamphlet. And the question I had, which has bothered me for some time and hopefully would be of some interest to your members, both individually and corporately. If we were to include a requirement that municipalities also have election pamphlets discussing ballot initiative, you know, ballot measures, how would your people feel about that? Some more disclosure there, so local voters know what they're voting on too.
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, I'm not versed clearly in municipal law. As a former assembly member for the Kodiak Island Borough, the clerk's office there did provide an election pamphlet prior to each local and special local election in the municipality of the Kodiak Island Borough. And when there were ballot initiatives, bond issues, et cetera, parties opposing and in favor were both given the opportunity to have an included statement for or against the ballot initiative or the bond package. So I can't speak to other communities, but Kodiak Island Borough does include that. The Kodiak Island Borough and the City of Kodiak do a joint typical brochure. So I don't know what other communities.
Thank you, Wayne.
May I follow with one question?
Representative Gruenberg.
Did the voters appreciate that?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, I can assume that they did.
Thank you.
Wayne, good luck this season.
Thank you for your time.
Next, we want to go to Mark Natt, and then I will make members aware that we have here in the room Jason Hooley and Gail from the Office of Lieutenant Governor, Gail Finami from Elections, but they're available for questions. But we are going to take off-net testimony from those who did sign up to offer testimony before we go to members here in the room. Mark, welcome. If you'd introduce yourself and any affiliation you have for the record, please.
Thank you, Representative Ramos. My name is Mark Gannat for the record, and I'm just representing myself today.
Welcome.
Thank you. Just feel a little person like you, Mr. Chairman. I feel a little personal touch to this bill. I've collected many signatures myself, from stormy, rainy days in Sitka to 30 below days in Barrow, and most often for initiatives I actually had some hand in, either in the as a former legislative staffer working on bills that later became initiatives, or on bills that I've just followed along through various parts of the process. And to me, I can go through and talk to specific issues in this bill. I think that the committee, from what I've heard, has heard a number of the specific issues. To me, it's just the initiative process is very valuable as part of a citizen of Alaska. I'm very proud to have an initiative process that does not come up with 150 bills like our initiatives like California. You know, at most we get a couple every year. Generally, they are pretty widely debated in the public. At least in recent years, we've seen quite a bit of back and forth after they get on the initiative, on the ballot. And to me, to try to enforce election laws on something that isn't even on the ballot yet is a little bit seems like somebody's trying to put a thumb on something that push back on a citizen process, and it's a little bit troubling to me to hear that. And so I think that it is perfectly right now to have people who are sponsoring or opposing a ballot measure to have to pay or to disclose who they are once it reaches the ballot. But before the lieutenant governor certifies it as a ballot initiative, the things that go on in back there is just about people trying to organize public support for an idea. It hasn't actually crossed over to being an official ballot measure yet. And I think that just blurring that line is kind of puts us on a slippery slope for other government requirements for speech and organizing and assembly. And I'm not a lawyer, so I don't know if that goes to the Constitution or not, but just as a citizen, kind of the red face test is, whoa, what are they afraid of here? The citizens speaking out, why are we trying to make this more difficult? Then you get into some of the other specific issues, and to me the problem is not how to make initiatives more difficult for the public, it's how to make it more easy for the public. They're already very difficult. Having, like I say, collected signatures in only 3 of the 30 required House districts myself, I know as part of the organization of, very loose-knit, I must add, organization of people that I spoke or worked with at that time, it was very hard to even make that requirement as it is, much less to organize some, I had to get a place to stay, much less organizing a committee meeting or public hearing or something like that. And so it seems like it's already a significant impediment for the public to do initiatives without these extra requirements. Only one thing I guess I would add in later on, I don't necessarily agree with too many sections in this bill, to be perfectly honest, but there are some that are better than others. But one thing with the committee hearings part of it, that seems to me if the intent of the bill is to just get more public information out there, and we feel it is the state's duty to somehow go that direction to make that happen, then I think that it would be worthwhile the state to take up that cause as opposed to putting that burden on the citizens who are trying to just enact a law that was either neglected by the legislature or not deemed appropriate through the time or whatever the reasons are. They feel that they have not had their needs met. I don't think we need to add the burden to them to actually have to pay for meetings in 30 of the 40 House districts. I think the state, if we're concerned about public information, that should be the state's serious. I think the state should pay for that. So that would be my only recommended amendment for anyone who so chooses to pick it up. And I'll end my testimony there.
Thank you, Mark. A couple of quick questions. Have you ever committed fraud?
No, sir.
When you've worked on these, have you ever witnessed anybody else committing fraud?
Honestly, yes, I have. I had not witnessed directly eye to eye, but there were some of the books that we collected. We had to, we just made sure that we always double checked everything. And there were a couple names that we noticed were, hey, that handwriting's pretty similar, like on 3 or 4 things. And we cleaned it up, and it was one petition gatherer. He never got a book back. And it was kind of well known amongst the small circle that you know of people that are available to do this, that guy got basically blackballed. People didn't want to deal with that hassle, and we self-policed it.
So. Thank you. And can you tell us a number of the initiatives that you've worked on?
4.
I'm sorry, not a number. Can you tell us the subject? I'm sorry. Can you tell us the subject of some of the initiatives that you've carried?
I worked on the Trust the People initiative. I've worked on the Clean Elections, I've worked on Clean Elections as well. I worked on campaign finance reform again. I've worked on the Alaska Gasline Now initiative. And those are the major ones I've worked on.
Do you vote?
I do.
Thank you. Representative Gatto?
Thank you. 2 questions. What was the success rate on the initiatives that you worked on?
Just off the top of my head, about 50%. The Gasline Now did not pass. Trust the People did pass.
And question 2 is carbon paper. is it even plausible that you could go and have a fake signature passed through carbon paper on five people in a row without somebody punching you out?
Representative Gatto, through the chair, probably not, actually. I would probably have a black eye. Just knowing the amount of people, they do ask questions. Very few people would, especially I had a lot of fairly charged initiatives, I will admit, that I was carrying. And people would have a lot of questions. And having worked on a lot of them in the process developing the bill, I could answer a lot of their questions in as much depth as they wanted. And there was, but to put a piece of carbon paper, especially in Juneau or Southeast Alaska, for one thing, it's not very practical of a thing in Southeast. And but people do check, and they always flip the page for some reason. I'm not sure if this was your experience, Mr. Chairman, or not, but people just flip the pages and look to see what the book's all about. They kind of look at it like my my three-year-old who just had his third birthday a couple days ago. He looks at all of his toys, just kind of checks it all out, and they people do that. They flip through the books. So I don't think it would happen.
Mark, one of the aspects I do like about this is carrying the full language of the bill with you. Do you think that's a positive part of this piece of legislation?
I do. I think that would be, I would actually have, I actually did that on my own just so that I could refer to people and have my credibility. So I don't find that a problem at all.
Other questions, Representative Gatto?
One more. Do you ever have like a short description that says lower taxes, sign here?
No, that would people in Alaska are generally smart enough to not not buy the bumper sticker right off the bat, especially if they're putting their name on something. The people generally want to ask questions. You know, you'll get a few of those easy dollars, so to speak. People will say, "Oh, I'll sign it" or whatever. But that's very much the minority. I was my experience.
Thank you. Other questions, Mark? We thank you very much, for Representative Grunberg.
Yeah, I believe it's maybe Section 10 that deals with the dollar payment. Are you familiar with the sponsor substitute of the bill here, Mark?
I have version E.
Yeah, that's the one. What do you think about Section 10? Do you think that's a good idea, or should we leave the law the way it is?
Let me just flip there, Representative Grunberg.
It gets away from the dollar per signature.
Yes, I found the dollar, or through the chair, I found the dollar per signature a great motivator for me. I use this in times between jobs or during the interim as a session-only staffer, and it was a very good motivator, much like we have our sales teams on, in any number of businesses have commission sales. It's a very accepted practice, and we don't legislate that the sales representatives, you know, we trust them, and if not, we know that the business will take care of that problem. I feel that it's kind of a similar.
I don't need an answer now, but I'd appreciate it if you take a look carefully at the current law, which you know how to read this, and proposed language and any other suggestion, and either, you know, after the meeting here, talk to Allison or myself. I'd like your careful view on Section 10.
Great. I'd be happy to do that, sir.
Thank you. Okay, let me give some instructions to members, please, and to Representative Johansson and Sonia. We appreciate your accommodation and flexibility today. Mark, thank you very much for your compelling testimony. We appreciate you finding us in the morning, and I appreciate your being so articulate. So we have heard from the folks that are in the room. We are going to miss Janine St. John and with the Alliance, and Jason Bruni with the Resource Development Council, who signed up to speak over the phone. We also have available Holly Hill and Chris Ellingson from APOC, as well as Jason Hooley from the Lieutenant Governor's Office and Gail Fanami from Elections. My intention is this afternoon at 1 o'clock is going to be to convene the 1 o'clock session to take public testimony on House Bill 36 so that we can go through and then close public testimony on House Bill 36. At that time, we're going to set House Bill 36 aside. We're going to take up the death penalty bill. We're going to go through the amendment process. And at such point in time where we have exhausted amendments and committee we're not going to exhaust committee discussion, but we are going to go through any amendments that members wish to offer. At that point in time, we're going to set HB 9 aside, because I promised that all members would be here to vote on that bill, so we will set it aside and take it up when Representative Dahlstrom rejoins the committee, and we have all seven of us here, which has been difficult, in case members haven't noticed, over the last 3 weeks to accomplish. At that point in time, then we will go back to House Bill 36 and try and take it up, and I would recommend that the sponsor have a conversation with the Rules Chair about the about House Bill 36, and we will try and move through this as rapidly as possible so that we can move things out of this committee and move them into the system. That is our intention for this afternoon. Representative Gatto?
Just a comment. As soon as we can, after 1 o'clock, because of floor session.
Yes.
You did mention at 1 o'clock, and for people that are listening, recognize that it could be later.
Because we don't know how the debate between Malamutes and sled dogs is going to...
Mr. Chairman, I think that'll be a hot one.
I think we're going to make the gooey duck the state dog.
All right, with that, it's 10 o'clock, and we're adjourned for this morning.
Congress.